feel very happy that I made the choice I made, and yeah. And I'm and I will follow up with the other surgery at some point because my mother had breast and ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to have started, you know, my life now is very much having, I meet so many women, we talk about these issues.
And you've changed, I mean, you know, so many people have done what must be a tough decision because of what you've done as well. Does that feel a weight on your shoulders to have inspired that or not? Or is that
I received a letter the other day from a woman who said that she got checked and found out that she had it and she'd already been through the surgery and she's home and she's happy and she's with her kids. And if just for that letter, just for that one, that's you know, very moving to me.
Angelina Jolie talking to the BBC last year about her decision to have a double mastectomy. Without the procedure, she says she had an 87% chance of developing breast cancer. Today, in an op-ed in the New York Times, Jolie announced she's also had her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed, an attempt to avoid ovarian cancer. We'll talk later about the risks and benefits of this kind of radical preventive surgery. But first, teachers and administrators in Los Angeles are at an impasse. Later today, some teachers in Los Angeles plan to boycott faculty meetings and rally at schools across the district. They're pushing for salary increases and smaller class sizes. Superintendent Ramon Cortinas has warned that boycotting faculty meetings violates state law, and he says he'll dock teachers' pay if they go through with it. For more on this, I have representatives from both sides now. Alex Caputo-Pearl is president of the union. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Thomas Waldman, spokesman for the school district. And welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And let's begin with you, Alex. What does the teachers' union want?
Well, we're looking forward to the mediation process, which is starting on Thursday. We declared impasse, so we have a state-appointed mediator coming in to help with stuff. We want reduced class size. We've got 3,000 classrooms across the city with over 45 students in them. We want increased staffing to meet the social and emotional needs of students. California and LAUSD are among the worst counselor-to-student ratios in the country. We want pay to be able to recruit and retain educators as we head into a period where the demographics are going to shift among educators. And we want a rescission of 609 layoffs that the district is threatening to go through on. These are common sense demands, and those are the things that we want to try to resolve in mediation.
And you want an 8.5% one-year pay raise, right?
8.5% increase is what we have on the table. We currently sit at 47th out of 47 districts in L.A. County in terms of maximum educator pay. And we're not going to be able to recruit and retain educators sitting at the bottom like that.
And the district is offering 5%.
Correct.
Okay. So how does today's action, not attending faculty meetings, how does that advance your cause?
Well, we're trying to walk with both feet here. Like I said, we're optimistic about the mediation process, but we also know that we've had to fight and scrap for everything that we can get. Over the last 6 years, we've been cut to the bone at schools. It's been 8 years without a pay increase. We spent 3 years under one of the most top-down superintendents in the country. And so under those conditions, and also after 4 years with an expired contract, we know that we have to organize to put pressure on the district as well. So these faculty meeting boycotts are the next step to show how committed we are to the demands that I just went over. It involves every member at work sites. It does involve some risk, but it also indicates that this can't be business as usual, and we need to actually move things forward. And of course, these boycotts will not affect students negatively in any way.
And how many teachers are participating?
This is a citywide action. We're going to have 35,000 educators across the city participating.
35,000. Okay, to you, Thomas Waldman, what do you say when you hear that 35,000 teachers will be boycotting faculty meetings today?
Well, again, as you pointed out, the superintendent is following the law, and the law, which is very clear, it comes from the Public Employment Relations Board 25 years ago when there was the last strike by UTLA, is that boycotting meetings is an unlawful action, and the superintendent will be withholding pay. He's said this in a letter to all employees for those employees who participate in the boycott. But I think something that goes beyond that, which can't be measured in dollars, what will the environment be like on campuses tomorrow as students come to class and there was a boycott, and perhaps all the faculty at a particular campus participated, perhaps half of them did, In any event, that's going to increase the tension on campuses because UTLA has talked about the boycott in terms of escalating actions. And what that can only mean in the end is a strike. UTLA has talked about preparing for a strike. They're not being secretive about it. They're being very open about it. The last time there was a strike in this district in 1989, I've talked to people who were there at the time. I'm sure Alex has as well. It was devastating. You had campuses in which some of the teachers participated and some didn't. And as a consequence, there was sort of a civil war on campus for years afterwards. The teachers who did participate were angry and in some cases didn't speak to the teachers who didn't participate. You can imagine the impact on kids who are there in class wanting to learn and seeing this going on. So we fervently hope it doesn't come to this. But when terms like escalating actions are used, what else are we supposed to conclude?
Alex Caputo-Pearl, what else are they supposed to conclude?
Well, we've been very clear with the public and with parents and others that the way to avoid something like that is to actually get the district to meet some of these very common sense demands before a strike actually occurs. These boycotts are not going to increase tension between teachers and students. Students aren't paying attention to what goes on in faculty meetings. Unfortunately, faculty meetings aren't used in the way that they should be, so they often aren't helpful for educators either. In fact, students across the city, as we saw in our February 26th rally at Grand Park, where we had over 15,000 people there, students have united with teachers in these common sense demands, like lower class size, like more counselors, like more access to electives, things like that. So this is not something that's increasing tension. To the contrary, it's actually helping build a movement for the schools that LA students deserve.
And Thomas Wellman, what about that? Aren't teachers, aren't they allowed to make their voices heard? And isn't this maybe an effective way of getting the attention of not only your office, but the public to their needs and their cause and their point of view?
Well, time will tell. It may be an effective strategy. I'm not sure. There may be a backlash because the general public may see this as something that teachers shouldn't be engaged in because it will lead or could very well lead to a strike. You know, Alex likes to point out comparative figures, and that's fair enough, but it always should be remembered that in this district, employees get fully paid benefits for themselves and their dependents, current employees, and the same for retirees. On the list I have of major districts in this state, there's no other district that offers those benefits, and we're proud to do so. But that certainly has a consequence for the budget. Alex also talks about the fact that teachers didn't get a raise over the last 6-7 years. We were in the midst of a terrible budget crisis in this district, $2 billion in reductions total, and all our employees were affected. And we're pleased to be at a position where we can offer the teachers a 5% salary increase retroactive to July 1st of last year. And that's an increase over the 2% that we offered originally. UTLA has rejected that. They're holding out for 8.5%. As Alex said at the beginning of this conversation, a mediator is coming in Thursday, and we are optimistic that's something both sides agree on, that the mediator will be able to get us to a point where we have an agreement and the fear of a strike will go away.
And Alex, what about this claim that this is illegal to mount these protests today, to not attend faculty meetings today? And as you say, you're meeting with the mediator on Thursday. Why not just wait and mediate and sit down at the table and discuss these issues rather than take this public action, which Cortina says is illegal?
Things have moved in this process because we have sat down with the district, but also because we've been organizing a movement of our members, of parents, of students, of community organizations across the city, and these faculty meeting boycotts, which again do not affect students in the least, are the next step in that. Ramon Cortinas has said that he may dock people's pay, and you know, if he chooses to do that, we're actually proud that we're fighting for something. It's much bigger than a one-hour pay dock, and that's the quality of education in Los Angeles around the demands that I've talked about. And the district does have money for a fair agreement. We just saw the Daily News article, John Daisy walking away with $440,000 dollars last year. The district projections have gone from an $165 million deficit, which they thought for this year just 8 months ago, and now they're saying they're going to end this year with a $45 million surplus. You've got projected $210 million additional dollars in revenue coming in next year, followed by an additional $110 million the following year. And we also just learned that the district is claiming that they've got a $47 million hole in their budget because of John Daisy's disastrous MISIS computer information system, which failed to count attendance and is now coming back to bite us with a $47 million hole in the budget. We say to Ramon Cortinez, go with us to Sacramento to talk to the state about recouping that money so that our students don't have to bear the burden of $47 million lost. So the money is there to actually come to a fair agreement.
Okay. And Tom Swaldman, I'll give you a chance to respond to that. When it comes to today's action and the boycotting of the faculty meetings, is, you know, as Cortina said in his letter, it is illegal. And as you said on just a few minutes ago, it's illegal according to state law. So what does that mean in terms of what the district is prepared to do? Will it actually go forward and dock teachers' pay? Would it sue the union?
I don't know about suing the union, but the superintendent is adamant, and unless something changes that I'm unaware of, that pay will be withheld. It's not going to be an easy process. I think Alex is confident that he'll get all 35,000 teachers to walk, to boycott. I don't know that that's the case, which means that there will have to be some head counting in terms of who did participate and who didn't, and it's not going to be easy for payroll to sort this out. But the superintendent is following the law. I do want to say something. I don't want to get into the dollars figures with Alex, but I do want to say something about his point regarding the faculty meetings. He acts like they're frivolous and that there will be no impact whatsoever on campus. And by the way, this is the first of three boycotts between now and April 14th that UTLA has called. So this is not the only faculty meeting that UTLA intends to boycott if there's not an agreement by the 14th of April. This would be the first of three. I've been told that faculty meetings, there are substantive conversations around policy, around budget issues at the school site, and we're looking at a situation in which faculty members won't be there. They're going to be missing some important information. This also will be a subject of conversation on campuses tomorrow, no doubt. And while there may be no direct, immediate impact on students, they will be around these conversations, and they may at times get heated, and there will be, I would imagine, some tension about it. So I think just to dismiss that there's no impact on students, no psychological impact, is dreaming.
Well, Alex, do you think there will be some kind of psychological impact or at least some kind of unease, especially as you go forward with more of these boycotts and then a possible strike? I mean, you have not ruled out a strike. In fact, you talk about it a lot. Is that in any way upsetting students and parents on campus?
Well, I taught for 22 years in South L.A., most of those years at Crenshaw High School, at some of the hardest-hit schools, hard hit by budget cuts and everything else. And I have worked with very good administrators who made good use of faculty meetings at different times in my career. But often, there is not good use made of that time across the city. And certainly, important information can be gotten out to faculty by other means, by a skilled administrator other than through a faculty meeting. I have never run into a parent. I have never run into a student. I've never run into a community organization or a religious leader who was concerned about whether I attended faculty meetings. This is an escalation of actions. We can solve this problem. We can solve this loggerheads at negotiations with the mediator, and we want to move forward to that. But what we're doing is we're taking action, collective action, that doesn't affect students, and the faculty meeting boycotts are the next step in that.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of the L.A. Unified Teachers Union, and Thomas Waldman, spokesman for the L.A. Unified School District. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right, we want to know what you think. Are teachers in Los Angeles paid enough? The average salary is around $76,000 a year. Let us know by leaving a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Also, let us know what you think of their action today. Boycotting, do you think it's an effective protest tool, or do you think it is not worth the possible pain and suffering that it might cause. Possible, of course. Leave a comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, Angelina Jolie's decision to remove her ovaries and fallopian tubes as a preventive measure. We'll talk to a woman who did the same thing. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It was quite a shock 2 years ago when Angelina Jolie announced she had undergone a double mastectomy. Jolie revealed she was a carrier of a gene mutation of BRCA1, the mutation of that gene, which she said gave her an 87% chance of getting breast cancer later in life. Today, in an op-ed in the New York Times, she announced her ovaries and fallopian tubes were recently removed as well. Her mother died of ovarian cancer when she was 56 years old. Joining me now is Lisa Resendi. She is 44 years old, and she carries the same gene and had her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed 3 years ago. She also had a double mastectomy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, how old were you when you found out you had this gene mutation?
I found out I had the mutation when I was 37 years old, after my mother, who was a long-term ovarian cancer survivor, had tested for it.
So what did you do after that? You found out you had this mutation, and then what did you do?
So after I went through the testing to find out that I had the mutation, I consulted with a genetic counselor who referred me to a high-risk clinic for breast and ovarian cancer. So I was assigned a high-risk oncologist to talk about breast health and a high-risk gynecological oncologist to talk about ovarian cancer health. And we went over the different options I had in terms of screening, in terms of possible preventative measures, and risk-reducing surgery.
And you decided to do the surgery?
So I initially decided to do the surgery first on my breasts because my first mammogram had a spot on it. And although it turned out not to be cancer, I could tell that was sort of going to be the way things were going to go from here on out. So I did a double mastectomy in 2008 and then moved on to the ovaries later on.
Okay. And so was it a very difficult decision for you to make?
It's a very difficult decision. I've got a biology background, and I understand the importance of the ovaries and overall female health, that even when you're done with childbearing, that losing your ovaries is going to put you into surgical menopause, and that that could potentially have, you know, health effects and physical effects, just like Ms. Jolie said in her op-ed. However, there's not reliable screening for ovarian cancer. While I was on a screening regime, it was clear to me that that wasn't necessarily going to catch a cancer at an early, more treatable stage. And so as I got older and closer to the age of where most ovarian cancer is detected, it seemed like the most prudent decision to remove the ovaries and fallopian tubes.
Did you ever consider you might want to wait?
I did wait, in a sense. I did wait about 5 years after testing before I went ahead and had the surgery. At that point, I was 10 years younger than my mother when she had gotten ovarian cancer. And getting past 40, you're starting to get where you start seeing more cases of ovarian cancer and BRCA1 carriers, and I didn't want to wait any longer.
Okay. Now, Angelina Jolie said her risk was something like 87% for developing breast cancer and about 50% for developing ovarian cancer. Was that your odds as well?
Yeah, so there's risk ranges that are given based on the mutation, and I'm a BRCA1 carrier as well, and so those are the risk range are in that area, so yes.
Okay, and so now what is your risk of developing cancer?
So these are risk-reducing surgeries. Mm-hmm. They do not completely eliminate risk, and I believe that the risk for after you've had your ovaries and fallopian tubes, there's still a risk for something called primary peritoneal cancer that's in about a 2 to 4% risk range, which is about what a normal person's ovarian cancer risk may be a little bit higher, and it depends on what study you're looking at and that sort of thing. There's also about a slight risk of breast cancer still because you can't get all of the breast tissue out. But it's much, much lower than the lifetime risk that I was looking at before and easier to live with.
And you have children, right?
Yes, I have 2 children.
So you had had your children. So that was, some women, I guess, have to make the decision before they have children to do this and go into surgical menopause. So that adds another layer onto that decision. What have been the effects for you after having the surgery? What are some of the effects that you've had to deal with?
So I went on to hormone replacement. Most experts believe that for a woman who is before the age of normal menopause and has not had breast cancer before, a low dose of hormone replacement is an option. And just as Ms. Jolie said in her op-ed, I made a similar decision. And that has made the effects milder. I had some sleep issues involved, a little bit of insomnia, but with the hormone replacement, most of it's very manageable.
And what do you think of Angelina Jolie's decision to be so public about her surgeries?
She's being so public in such a graceful manner with well-informed and being respectful of all women's choices that I think it's been, you know, really important. There's something, I work with an organization called FORCE, Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered, and we work with families with hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, and so many people started looking at the cancer in their family after her initial disclosure of her mutation, and the fact that she is very empowering and respectful of all the different decisions that somebody who's at high risk can make and not just saying that hers is the way to go, I think is really important.
Well, Lisa Resende, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Also on the line, Dr. Leslie Randall, Assistant Professor of Gynecological Oncology at UC Irvine School of Medicine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Well, when you hear stories like that, do they sound familiar? Were there a lot of women who came to you after Angelina Jolie's first disclosure that she had had a double mastectomy looking to be tested and looking to perhaps undergo the same surgery?
There were. You know, I had had some patients already coming in, and you know, Mr. Sendi did a great job explaining. I mean, she explained it almost from a medical provider's point of view, and so organizations like FORCE have been in place prior even to Ms. Jolie's announcement, and have been, I think, the driving force, if you will, behind getting women information and getting them into the office for counseling, as well as the breast cancer doctors have been really good about counseling their patients toward considering the risk-reducing removal of the tubes and ovaries. When Angelina Jolie made her announcement, though, I think that we did see a little bit of a bump in people coming in, but I think people were becoming more comfortable with their own autonomy in the decision, mm-hmm. if you will. So it was almost like there was more anxiety approaching this prior to there was before she came out. So I think that she did a lot to put sort of a human face on what is otherwise sort of a seemingly scientific and to some even science fiction with all the genetics involved. She really put a face to this diagnosis.
Right. Now, these two surgeries, these are radical surgeries. And what are the risks? What are the risks for carriers of this gene mutation? Is it really 87% like she wrote for breast cancer?
The risk is really hard. We call these relative risks because they're estimated risks. And just like Ms. Resende shared with you, they vary. There are ranges, and they depend on, you know, what population you look at, what studies you're quoting. There's a higher, what we call penetrance, a higher number of women with BRCA1 mutations will actually get breast or ovarian cancer than, say, BRCA2 mutations. There's another family of genetic disorders that leads to ovarian cancer, and that's also called Lynch syndrome. That's even less ovarian cancer. So it really varies, and I don't think that we have a good estimate just yet. I think it's going to take some time to really test more and more people to really get good estimates. I think that there are probably more BRCA carriers out there than we suspect. And we think about 10% of ovarian cancer is due to genetic mutation, but the more we learn, the more that rate is probably going to approach 25 to 30, if not more, percent.
Well, so is part of the calculation that it's really hard to detect ovarian cancer early when it's treatable?
That we could have a whole show about that. Really, detecting ovarian cancer early is just about impossible. And the reason being is that the ovarian cancer has direct access to the internal organs of the abdomen. And it's just about as soon as an ovarian cancer forms, it can spread into the abdomen. And we refer to that as a stage 3. So that's technically an advanced cancer. That happens very quickly. So to have meaningful screening, you would really have to do it about every 3 months. And the average person who's really not at risk for ovarian cancer, that's a lot of anxiety for very low yield. For someone who's at risk that carries a mutation, screening might be actually useful. And we have a large trial that's ongoing through the National Cancer Institute to really look at what screening does for our more at-risk population. It's probably more effective. But we really need to focus our efforts on prevention and improving our treatments.
Prevention. How do you prevent ovarian cancer if you have a gene mutation?
So we've been talking about the risk-reducing surgery. That's probably the most powerful way to reduce your risk. But like you said, that's a radical step towards that. There are other ways to reduce your risk. Using birth control pills will reduce your risk for ovarian cancer. That's been shown in several different studies. The protective effect of birth control pills is if you use birth control for about 10 years, the estimated risk reduction in ovarian cancer is 90%. And that is prolonged over your lifetime. So even if you stop taking the birth control pill in your 30s, that protection doesn't go away when you're in your 50s and 60s. For BRCA carriers, that protection is less. So you're going to be more reliant on the surgical methods of prevention.
All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Leslie Randall. She's an assistant professor of gynecologic oncology at UC Irvine's School of Medicine. So, is this something that you have considered, getting tested for the BRCA1 gene mutation? Let us know on Facebook or call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, we have some book recommendations for you, the best of spring and looking forward to summer. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Some of the biggest names in literature are dropping new releases in the coming months. Toni Morrison, Milan Kundera, Harper Lee. But beyond those headliners, there are some pretty amazing opening acts you should check out as well. And for a look at the latest great reads and the books you should be watching out for in the coming months, Pamela Paul is here. She's editor of the New York Times Book Review. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, but before we get to those big heavyweights that are coming up soon, let's talk about what has caught your eye recently as editor and some of the standout books. And one of them that was gracing your pages recently was this kind of unlikely book about a woman who trains a hawk to get over the death of her father.
This is a really interesting book. It's Ages for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, a memoir by an academic and a falconer who, while dealing with the death of her father, decided that she would train one of the most difficult hawks, a goshawk, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And she wrote a memoir about it. And It kind of defies what you would expect from a first-time memoir by a relative unknown. She's British. She is at Oxford, in that it has gone to the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list, almost immediately. It's become this huge hit. It came out in the UK first, and there it won the Costa Prize for the best book of the year. It won the Samuel Johnson Prize. It was excerpted in Vogue. As you mentioned, it was on our cover. The Daily New York Times gave it a rave review. And it's just kind of broken out in this amazing way.
And why is that? What do you attribute that to?
You know, well, it has a few things going for it, in that people love books about the relationship between human and animal. Mm-hmm. You know, usually it's a dog, not often a bird. So it's a bit exceptional in that regard. I also think that there is in the air a lot of books, a lot of people interested in grieving and end of life. We still have at the number one New York Times bestseller now on the nonfiction side is Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, which is about that end of life period. Period and sort of how people go. But it's also about grieving in that there is a bit of memoir. Atul Gawande's own father dies in the course of that book. So it's a little bit about that process. And then last year, of course, you had Roz Chat's book.
Oh, yeah.
Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?
Which is unbelievable. Oh, like, it keeps winning awards, and justly so, I thought.
Yes. Yeah. It was one of our 10 best books of the year. And I'm a sucker for a really good graphic memoir. That's a phrase that never sounds right. A graphic novel / memoir. But it was just so beautifully done. And I think that it's a subject right now that's getting a lot of attention. And H's for Hawk deals with that.
Mm. All right. So H's for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. And Katsuo Ishiguro, he is more well known.
Yes.
Also from Britain. He has a new novel out, The Buried Giant, which is unlike The Remains of the Day or any other book that he has written.
Yeah, he's one of these authors that's very hard to sort of peg him in a certain genre, because he really goes all over the place. But this, I think, is even a departure from things like Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go, in that it is a bit fantastical. There are giants and other fantastical creatures. It takes place in this Middle Earth kind of England. And apparently when he was trying to figure out where to set his story, he thought about places like Bosnia, other places that would be more recognizable to us. But then he worried that rather than readers focusing on the themes that he wanted to explore and the ideas of the book, that they would focus on the particulars of the place. So he decided to set it somewhere where people would have very few preconceptions about and wouldn't assume that, aha, Ishiguro is addressing the issues of ancient Britain. So, you know, it's a book that I think thus far has kind of divided critics.
Yeah.
Neil Gaiman reviewed it for us, and I would call his appreciation sort of restrained appreciation. It wasn't a hugely enthusiastic review. Other places have been more critical. And then some people love it. I was at the Miami Book Fair late last year, and Ann Patchett, who, of course, is a very enthusiastic reader and bookstore owner and author in her own right, was clutching a copy the entire time, telling everyone that she met that they had to read this book. So,
well, it's interesting because from what I've read, that he is writing again about family loss, and which seems to be his big through line.
Yes.
That he's really interested in how we handle loss and how we move on or don't move on. And so this is about a couple looking for their missing son.
Yes. It's about memory. It's about regret. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, how we grapple with the past. So
again, the bereavement theme.
Yes. It's all it's all very dreary.
Know, let's
I have
move on to something
spring.
a little happier. Would that be the Whites, which is Richard Price writing as Harry Brandt?
I don't know if like gritty, brutal crime is necessarily
is
cheerful, but it's definitely, you know, very good, high quality literary genre writing. And what was interesting about this book is that he decided to write under a pseudonym, Harry Brandt, and then after he'd written the book, I think, kind of reconsidered. He thought it was pretty good, and why hide behind another name? And so he sort of took ownership of it.
But why did he want to do that in the first place?
I think he wanted to, you know, a lot of writers will take on a pseudonym when they kind of try out a new genre. I think it's a way of sort of self-protecting and perhaps also giving the reader the opportunity to take it on its own merits and not necessarily think of it as a Richard Price novel. And Richard Price, of course, is well known for Lush Life, for Clockers, for The Wanderers.
But isn't this the same genre? It's a crime.
It's, I guess it's more crimey noir. Crime, you know.
Okay.
It's a little bit.
And The Whites is not, it doesn't refer to white people or
no.
white.
No, but it's, you know.
But The White Whale, as in cases that haven't been solved.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so far, everyone I know at least has loved it. And Michael Connelly, of course, an L.A. person, reviewed it for us, and he was wildly enthusiastic.
Well, this is interesting because we're talking about reinvention a little bit here with Richard Price and also Katsuo Ishiguro and reinvention of the form. And that has been an interesting through line with some recent novels that have been published, novels in quotes.
Yes. I mean, the biggest one, of course, and we won't spend too much time about talking about him because everyone has already talked about him a lot, but it's Karl Ove Knausgård's My Struggle. The fourth volume is coming out soon. And these are these incredibly lengthy books that, you know, people just don't know what they are. But I think many readers feel like it's a reconsideration of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then there have been a number of books that have been sort of playing with the lines between memoir and novel. The one most notable one this spring was Rachel Cusk's Outline. And Rachel Cusk, of course, is a novelist. She's written a number of novels, but the two books that have probably gotten her the most attention in the U.S., she's another British writer, have been memoirs. And the last one, Aftermath, was quite controversial about her divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And this novel then also deals with divorce. And again, it's just blurring that line between writing about the self and invention.
And Heidi Julowitz, she has a new book coming out.
She has a new book coming out.
Is along the same line?
Well, what she's done is very interesting. She's playing with form all over the place. Heidi Julowitz is known primarily as a novelist. That's really what she has written, The Mineral Palace. And I think she's written four novels in total. This is, the subtitle is that it's a diary. But it really is unlike any other diary. First, it is not chronological. So she skips around in time. And she'll have an entry from August and then go to April and then go to November. And she's constantly playing back and forth with time. She got the idea because she had kept a diary when she was 10. And she thought, well, this is how I became a writer. She went back and read those diaries and found that they were just awful, that there was absolutely no evidence of writerly talent or literary quality. But what was interesting is that when she was 10, she began each entry with today I. So today I was overwhelmed with homework, or today I found out that, you know, so-and-so was mad at me. And so she does the same thing with this new diary. Over a course of a 2-year period, she records these entries and always begins with today I. And what follows are these memoiristic kind of essays.
Okay, so that's coming out next month. Also coming out next month, Toni Morrison's book, God Help the Child, and she hasn't written a novel in quite some time.
Yes. She was just given a major award by the National Book Critics Circle Association in New York last week, a lifetime achievement. And of course, she is an icon, and anytime a novel of hers comes out, it's quite
an
occasion. It's a big event. This novel, I should say, is short in length, which is somewhat of another literary trend. I mean, you have obviously books like The Goldfinch, but most of the novels recently that have caught a lot of attention and readership have been relatively short. So this is a short book coming out from her. And it would have been, I think, the literary event of the season had it not been, of course, for the news that Harper Lee is wittingly or unwittingly releasing a second book, Go Set a Watchman, which is coming out in July. And, you know, then you also have Milan Kundera coming out with a novel, and it's not even fall yet. And this fall actually looks to be like it's going to be a big, big season.
Really?
Yes.
So who are the big names this fall?
You have Jonathan Franzen. You have Salman Rushdie. There's the new Elena Ferrante, the latest in her Neapolitan. What was meant to be a trilogy,
there's
a fourth book. And then the biggest unknown of the season is a new book by Garth Risk-Hallberg, a first-time novelist who was paid an enormous advance. I think it was on the record as $2 million. So people are watching out for that
one. For a first-time novelist?
Yes, coming out in October. And everyone says that it will sort of transform your life. It takes place in 1970s New York.
Well, that's, hot, sexy.
Yes.
And I think the book is called City on Fire?
Yes. Yes.
How does that happen, that one thing captures the attention and the buzz of the publishing industry to such an extent that you get a $2 million advance?
It doesn't happen as often as it used to. And so I think that that's why there's so much more excitement and attention. But there were a number of really big advances that happened late last year, and those books are coming out this year. Another one that got a major advance is actually from one of my colleagues, Stephanie Clifford, who has a big book coming out this summer called Everyone Rise. I think that every once in a while there is a writer who captures people's imagination. It happens more often with a novel because, of course, when an author submits nonfiction, they generally send in a proposal. It's like a business document that says, here's the book I'm going to write. So it's kind of hard to get too excited about that when you haven't seen the finished product and you don't know if somebody's actually going to hand in what they promised or if it's going to be, much worse. Whereas with a novel, especially when it comes in from an unknown, is already completed. And I think that, there's just this sense of surprise and delight on the part of editors when everyone reads something and says, oh my God, this is great, just to have that level of excitement. And, that's what people in publishing are in it for. That's what they're looking for. So when it really works, they get very excited.
I get excited.
Yes.
Excited to read something like that.
We've got lots to read.
You have lots to read.
Yes.
Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Warren Olney.
Hello.
You have a lot to read, too.
I do.
For your show.
I do.
Yeah.
Well, today we're going to talk about the Republicans. You remember they said, Mitch McConnell said famously, that if they won the Senate, they'd be able to govern, and they demonstrate that.
Well, I do remember that.
It doesn't look like that's turning out too well for them. And even Republicans are saying that it is not, largely because they are so divided amongst themselves. And I forgot the name now, of the caucus that used to have 20 people in it that now has 80 people in it, that is was formed because the conservative caucus wasn't conservative enough. Mm. Is now exerting a lot of influence. John Boehner really can't keep the things together. And McConnell has a problem over on the Senate side because he's got, among other things, three candidates for president who are supposed to be there to vote on things. And if they're not there, he might have to rely on Democrats, just as Boehner might ultimately have to do if they're going to get anything done at all, like maybe pass a federal budget.
You think, just the basics.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And we'll talk also about Yemen and a very a dangerous situation shaping up there, and about the fact revealed by the Wall Street Journal today that the Israelis have been spying on the negotiations with Iran over the nuclear program. Why should anybody be surprised, said one Israeli to the Wall Street Journal. After all, you taught us how to do it.
Okay. Looking forward to all of that.
Good
all
stuff.
Of that
Good
meaty
stuff.
Stuff at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on this program, why is Tuesday the day record companies release new albums? Well, now no longer. They've moved the day to Friday. We'll find out what that means for the entire industry, how we go about buying and listening to music, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and for as long as anyone can remember, this is the day all the big new albums drop here in the United States. But not anymore. The record industry has decided that Friday is the new day for new music everywhere in the world. Why? Well, two main reasons. Beyonce, and Piracy. Andrew Flanagan is an editor at Billboard, and he's written about the new release day. Hi there.
Hello.
Tuesday, why Tuesday in the first place? Seems like a strange day for a record release.
Well, Tuesday release day was set in 1999 by a group of distributors, which are the companies in charge of getting records to stores physically. And before then, it was Monday, and they had some troubles with shipping and various stores having different proximities to shipping distribution centers.
Uh-huh.
And so some of these stores would get their records on time, some would get them later in the day. So to combat that, they chose Tuesday.
So it seems kind of random. Why not Wednesday, Thursday?
Yeah, it was essentially random, and it still is. It's set in each territory. UK is Monday, so they just kind of decided Tuesday.
And now they're just kind of deciding Friday.
No, that's a specific choice. Friday is a day where a lot of online sales take place. It's also physical retailers' busiest day, and that's the main peg for why they chose this day.
Well, why have any day at all? Why not just release them when you release them?
In order to give physical retailers even playing field, if some people get their records on Monday and they can just put it out whenever, then the people who are further away from shipping centers, you know, in Alaska gets it 5 days later, they're at a disadvantage.
I see. But now that we buy things online, or we don't even buy albums as much anymore, we buy singles or we stream, does it really matter?
It still does to physical retailers who have a longer lead time. They need to get products in stores, register those products before they put them out on the shelves. It takes a lot of coordination, and those are where music fans go still, especially vinyl record buyers.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Beyonce factor. How was she influential in moving this to Fridays?
She kind of showed that artists of her caliber don't really need to do anything they don't want and can do whatever they want, including springing, you know, the year's biggest record on everyone with no notice.
Right. And then also more recently, Kendrick Lamar, you know, he released his latest album, didn't have anything to do with Friday or Tuesday.
Yeah. I spoke to a record store just a few blocks away from our office, and these are problems that they're having to deal with. For example, a few months ago, Bjork's new record leaked, and she put it out online immediately, which is good for her business-wise, but terrible for him. He has regular customers that come in and thought that they'd be able to get the record, and they can't. So he's less concerned about the day that it comes out than every format having a uniform release day.
Which is not happening.
That is not. This is just for physical retailers.
And is there any move to get that to happen?
Not that I know of, no.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem in a big artist's best interest to do that, because I would think that a Beyonce or a Bjork or a Kendrick Lamar would want to, you know, stick out of the pack and have the day all to themselves for maximum publicity.
Exactly. Kendrick Lamar's surprise release forced the conversation that dominated that entire week. Professional music critics can't ignore a new Kendrick Lamar record, nor should they. And the proof is in the pudding. I mean, he had the biggest first-day streams on Spotify that day and dominated the music conversation all week.
Right. So what do you think this is going to mean in the long run? Is this kind of tilting at windmills, moving the day to Friday? And, it's, you know, I mean, it seems like the record industry is kind of pushing back at this tidal stream of digital releases.
The main purpose of it was because Australia's release day is on Friday. A lot of pirates buy those records and upload them and kind of preempt the UK and US markets. So the effect they're hoping for is that it'll curb piracy and drive people to buy records as they used to.
Also, the Billboard charts come out on Tuesdays. So now that the release day has changed to Fridays, will that change too?
They've been talking to the people who are behind this change for a while. They haven't announced any specific plans to change, but they've made it clear that when and if the change goes forward, they'll be prepared well in advance. The one kind of lingering question is that for consumer behavior is that movies and TV and video games still come out on Tuesdays.
Oh.
So there's mild concern that there's still be some confusion around that.
What about us, the record-buying public? Do we in general care that there is a record release date that is now Friday instead of Tuesday?
I mean, I am a regular like vinyl record buyer, and going on Friday doesn't matter much to me.
Mm-hmm.
It does to retailers, though, because the Tuesday release day gives them a midweek bump. Generally, their busiest days are Friday and Saturday, so Tuesday kind of drives people to the stores, whereas they might normally not, which is a kind of a huge deal for them.
Yeah. How are record stores doing in general anyway?
Not great. I mean, there's a new documentary out by Colin Hanks about Tower Records, which is one of the most famous chains that's been long gone now. That was kind of a sea change, and the trend has continued.
Right. But except you do have these audiophiles. There are a lot of record stores in hipster neighborhoods now.
Yeah, they are. And they're all very niche. I've got one in my neighborhood of Bushwick, Brooklyn, that only sells, punk rock and industrial music.
That is really the epicenter right there.
Yeah, it's unsurprising. But they seem to do well. I mean, well enough to continue.
Right. Do they care about release day being moved to Friday?
I'm not sure that specific record store cares much about anything.
Because they're so punk rock.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Andrew Flanagan, editor at Billboard. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, Jolie Myers. Your name is quite Googleable. Can I say Googleable? God.
Whenever I Google myself, which is infrequent, by the way, I have to do the minus
like...
Angelina thing on there. Oh, yeah. If you do Jolie Myers, you get pictures of Mike Myers and Angelina Jolie together.
Not in one picture.
Sometimes in one picture. The 90s were a really weird time, okay? So, of course, we did talk about Angelina Jolie's decision to have her breasts and ovaries and fallopian tubes removed to prevent cancer. Many of our listeners had thoughts on this. Maria Hackett on Facebook says that everyone should be able to make this decision without regard to the costs. That's monetary costs. A lot of these decisions are put off because of the out-of-pocket office visit costs. Even a $10 or $20 out-of-pocket cost can be prohibitive for some people. Rebecca Beck says that she really admires Jolie for bringing attention to this issue and for pointing out that these kinds of surgeries aren't right for everyone. Each person has a different family history that should dictate their own personal path. Another story we followed today, tensions between teachers union here in LA and the superintendent. Part of that fight is over teacher pay. Erin Conti was surprised to learn that teachers here make an average of $76,000 a year. He says that's more than enough money to keep teachers in the classroom. The kids are counting on it. But Tully Scottist says that they certainly do not make enough money. They should get a raise, and they should also get special tax breaks like clergy members do. It is, after all, God's work.
All right, Jolie Myers, thank you very much. And if you'd like to weigh in on anything you've heard on the air or anything online, you can. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney is next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.